8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Knotfest.com presents Talk to Me. With over 300 interviews under his belt and 6 years running, your host Joshua Toomey interviews metal and rock's heaviest hitters. Follow the show at Talk to Me Talk. Here's your host, Joshua Toomey.
What is up, everybody? Welcome into Talk to Me here on Knotfest.com. The guest this week is Will Putney of Fit for an Autopsy. New album, Oh What the Future Holds, out January 14th. Nuclear Blast Records. Make sure you go check that out. It is awesome. Nice long chat with Will. We talk all things about the studio, working with Body Counts, working with Knocked Loose, writing, recording the new Fit for an Autopsy album, the ups and downs of recording bands these days, and so much more. What a cool guest to have on the show. If you like some producer talk, you will enjoy this episode. If you want to check out the video version of this episode, make sure you are over at Knotfest VIP. Get that VIP subscription. You can see the videos of all the interviews I've done on the Talk to Me podcast. And make sure to come and hang out with me tonight, Knotfest Twitch. Alan Roberts of Life of Agony will join us, and it's going to be an action-packed show. So make sure to come hang out in the chat, ask Alan Roberts some questions. It'll be a lot of fun. And since this is a long episode, let's check out a little bit of Fit for an Autopsy, talk to Will Putney, and then I will talk to you guys next Thursday.
How did they find me? How are they so?
guys, let's welcome the wonderful Will Putney of Fit for an Autopsy. And, you know, just he produced pretty much every single one of your favorite albums. So what's up, Will? How are we doing?
Thank you, my friend. Thank you for having me. I'm doing pretty good. Taking a nice recording break this week, playing some shows. So just hanging out, chatting.
So how does that work? I was watching some stuff on you a little bit earlier about, you know, you're kind of in the band, but you also send them off to play, to do shows. So, I mean, how does that work as a member of Fit for an Autopsy?
Well, a long time ago, I kind of realized as the band's touring started to become more of a full-time thing, this was like earlier in our career, I couldn't make all the commitments because I've had all these records to make. And I started to hit this fork in the road where it was like, you could tour full time or you could produce records full time, but you can't do both well,
right?
You know? So we had a discussion internally, like, what if we just got another band member, you know? And we found Tim, who's really good at guitar, better than me, loves playing live. He's like a road dog kind of dude. And it was just like this, it's kind of a strange, not typical approach to band dynamic, but he just loves playing live and it works great. And, we've just been rolling like that for a long time. I definitely, it's to the point now where like, I don't, you know, obviously there are times where I could go and play shows with the guys, but I feel like I'd just be throwing a wrench in it at this point, you know,
right.
They're a kind of a well-oiled tour machine at this point, and I'm kind of the studio guy, and you know, the dynamic works. We can multitask and get stuff done at home while they're on the road. And, it's been good. It's been easy, honestly.
So the new album, Oh What the Future Holds, out January 14th, Nuclear Blast Records. When you sit down to write a record and produce your own album, how tough is that for you to know that, you know, you're kind of known as a very good producer? You've produced some of the greatest bands of our generation, and you know, now you have to do your own album.
I used to think about it more. It used to bother me more, I think, earlier in my career, where I was like, oh, I'm going to be judged by this. This is like my band and a production I'm doing. I've learned over the years to stop caring about that kind of stuff.
Right.
I think Fit for me is like a kind of a creative outlet where we just write the music we want. We get to kind of do what we want. And I feel like very free in that sense, where it's like, I don't really care what people think about the music or the way the record sounds. It's like, I'm actually just doing the stuff I like. I'm glad people like it, you know, and I'm happy to take criticism because I think you can learn from that in some way. But, at the end of the day, I just got really comfortable making the music I wanted the way I wanted to with the band. And it's been really good. And I actually think the band got better when I just decided I would not care what people think about it, you know?
Is that when you're sitting there doing the producing side of things where you're like, God, this album sounds so good. I wish I was a part of this. And you kind of, there's like that great meme of the football player in full football gear in the stands. And it says, you know, how you feel as a musician at a show. I kind of feel like that's what you're talking about, like in real life.
Yeah. I mean, in a sense, I don't really like, I'm very comfortable with our process here at the studio, and you know, I'm confident in my abilities to elevate the bands that I work with that come in, whether that's like an outside band or even my own projects. Like, I'm just comfortable with the way I do things now, and a lot of that came from like letting go of that kind of stress and worry about what are people going to think about this. It's like you kind of just trust your instincts and you just go with what you think is going to make a cool song or a cool record. And it's been good. It's worked out like that. So I'm probably just continue down that path, you know.
In watching a little bit of the behind the scenes, it looks like you guys actually got you wrote a lot of the stuff, but you've gotten a room to hash it out. And I feel like in kind of this newer file sharing kind of world, I don't know how much of most bands are doing that these days. I kind of like seeing, you know, just getting in a room with each other and hashing it out. It's kind of nice.
Yeah, there's always that kind of element. I feel like all of my favorite bands probably make records like that. You have to sort of, you know, obviously I'm a computer savvy guy. I work well in a computer when I'm like trying to create my own music or write demos or things like that. But there's definitely an element where it, like, you have to sort of bring it to a band level, make sure things translate in the real world. We definitely, you know, design music that can be executed in a live setting, because I think it's an important part of the style that we play and the nature of the music that Fit writes, is like it has to be able to deliver live. And that's always in the back of our heads. Like, we wanted it to translate, on the stage as well as in the studio. So there's always like that final comb and check and, hey, let's make sure this is all, you know, obtainable and sounds right with, you know, real life musicians, not program things and stuff like that. So that stage is important. And I'm kind of, no matter what record, I mean, I've always like keeping ear out for that kind of stuff.
You're not getting tracks of drummers with, like, you know, where they're playing the hi-hat, the ride, and doing a fill all at the same time. You're like, you know, you can't do that, right?
I definitely get those. The guitarist programming is always hilarious. I love those demos where it's like, hey, does your drummer have five arms? Oh, okay.
6 feet?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's part of like, it's just part of working through it. I don't care, as long as, you know, if a band's just like trying to get stuff in quick in a computer and wants to get stuff done, it's like, oh, we'll catch it later. Don't worry about it. But yeah, I've seen some funny ones where I'm like, hey, you have two drummers? Just check. Yeah.
Is this like a Puya situation? What do we got going on here? You know, how many times have you gotten like the early demos of something or you're checking out something and then the guys show up and you're like, oh, this was all computer generated. Like, these guys can't play like this. Have you dealt with anything like that?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've been fortunate lately where I've the kind of over the years, I've been lucky enough where the bands I've recorded have become more veteran or more organized, right? Or maybe my starting point for the bands that come to the studio is pretty good now. So it's usually guys who can play and write and understand the process. And it's not, hey, surprise, I don't know how to do any of this. But I've definitely been in that scenario where I've heard a band or I've heard demos, I'm like, oh, this band's really good. And then day one of the studio, I'm like, uh-oh, we might have a problem. But it's never been a disaster. We've always been able to make cool records. So it's just being prepared when you come to the studio, like really knowing your stuff is such a lifesaver and a time saver. You know, I think it's a younger band misstep to think, oh, I'll figure it out in the studio. It's like when you really know your stuff and you can cut out that time constraint of like not knowing what's going on with the music. I mean, you really can make a better record.
So looking into your past a little bit, it looks like that, you know, necessarily record production wasn't kind of your path. You were interning, doing some other stuff, but I mean, was this a passion for you for a long time, or did you just kind of fall into this?
I mean, I was always super involved in music. Even through starting in high schools and bands, I continued through me going to school, and I was booking shows. I tried to run a little record label. I really didn't know a lot about record producing or making records as a career early on in my life. It really wasn't until I stepped foot in a studio in like an internship position where I was like, oh, this is how it works. This is cool. This could actually be something I do. It had just never entered my mind earlier in my life. You know, I would only recorded at little local studios. I'd never seen a record get produced per se, right? You know, just working with engineers and stuff. And I was fortunate enough to wind up in a studio with Machine, really knowing nothing about recording, just like acting as an intern, making coffee and stuff. And I very quickly figured out, like, this is what I want to do. Like, this is how I could see myself making music for my whole life, you know? So I jumped into it and just kind of learned as quick as I could and worked my way up the chain there and started producing my own records. And then it all just kind of snowballed from that. But, I always was involved in music, but I just never really found my calling as it for a career until I got into a studio, you know?
So was the first album that you kind of worked on was a Lamb of God record? I mean, that's, you're like walking into like the, you know, you're basically walking off the street, like onto to a major league team.
I mean, I came in at the very end of one and was not given lots of responsibility. You know, like, I'm the guy who was sending files and making coffee and right, cleaning up messes and things like that. But I really didn't, you know, it took a minute before I like could understand the concepts. And, you know, the great thing about working at that studio is like, even though I wasn't doing the work, I was watching all the, like, kind of the magic happen per se. And I very quickly learned the style and approaches of record producing and sort of the mindset and the whole mentality around it and like how to create the vision for bands. The technical stuff, never really had an issue with technical stuff, you know, is sort of an afterthought in this world. And a lot of people don't really realize that it's like, there are a million good engineers in the world, and setting up mics and you sort of the science behind recording, it's very obtainable if you have a technical mind. But the creative side, combining it with that, is what I really had never understood until I saw real records get produced. And that was the big catalyst and what changed everything. It was like sort of getting those concepts embedded into my brain.
How tough is it for you when you hear certain artists talk about when they write their new album and they're like, I stopped listening to music, or I don't listen to the radio because I don't want to get anything to give me inspiration. But I mean, you're not only listening to bands, you're like deep into, you know, what the bass is doing, what the guitar is doing. How influential are the bands that you work with on Fit for an Autopsy? Do you hear stuff when you're producing stuff and you're like, oh, I want to try something like that when I write a new song, things like that?
It's funny. I do get asked this question a lot. I think people think that might happen, but it's fully the opposite. Like, it actually teaches me what to avoid when I write my own music. Okay. Like, I work with great artists, like incredible drummers and guitar players. And I'm sure I'm sponging up little tricks and ideas and little, oh, he did that cool time signature thing. Like, there's stuff that just works its way into my head like that involuntarily. But it's really like, I'll see trends happen in metal and hardcore, and I'll see people chasing certain things, right, going for a certain sound, trying to copy some kind of band. Like, and as I see some of that stuff, it's sort of a turn off to me, or it's like, I don't want to write music like that, because now I see like a lot of people doing this. This is what everyone's trying to do. We already got that band. That band does it the best. Like, it really teaches me to avoid stuff. So when I sit down to write for Fit, I want my own lane. Like, I want our band to have its own identity. I want it to sound, you know, not really like anybody else in our world or our genre. So I try to steer clear of the things that seem like are more common and are happening more frequently in the genres from hearing what I hear on the records I produce. So it's like a tool of avoidance more so.
I like that answer a lot. That's very smart. How often have you sat down with a band and you're like, come on, man, that's what that band just did. Like, I know what you're doing. Stop it.
It's usually by accident. It happens all the time by accident, because I have this encyclopedia of stuff. Like, I've recorded over 14 years, 15 years, where I'm like, sometimes a flag will go off where I'm like, I feel like I've heard this before. I swear I know this line. I know this riff. And then it might take a second. It might take a day. I'll think about it. I was like, dude, I've recorded this. Like, I know I've recorded.
Right.
Sometimes, I mean, there's like a lot of bands have similar subject matter, similar styles. Like, it's bound to happen. Sometimes it's just a pure accident, you know? I mean, I've definitely seen guys chasing other bands, trying to copy things where I'm like, hey, this is like a little too on the nose, you know? But, you know, generally lately, a lot of the bands I've worked with, I feel like have their own identity, and I'm really not running into that problem as frequently, you know. I think everybody wants to be their own thing at the end of the day, so it's always a drive to like, let's find what's cool about you and why people are connecting with your band, and that's what we're always like zooming in on here. So I like to think we run into that issue less.
Have you wrapped your head around the fact that like you're one of those producers that when it says X band is working with Will Putney, you're like, oh shit, this is going to be awesome. Like, you know, it's to that point now.
I mean, that's awesome. I appreciate that people like what I do. You know, I to me, it still feels like every record is the same challenge that it was like when I started making records. So no matter what scale the band is or what size, it's always like the same goal, the same task. I'm always, whether it's one of the smallest bands I work with or one of the biggest, I still have this common goal in mind, you know. And I, you know, the fact that maybe that's what translates to, you know, listeners where they get excited from doing a record is because I'm going to put it through that process and try to treat it as special and try to find these important things in the band and that makes their songs connect with people. So it's very flattering. I'm very humbled by it. I'm just doing what I feel like I've been selected to do to the best of my ability.
For the longest time, my Jeep, my CD player had Bloodlust stuck in it. And I probably listened to that album like 1,000 times.
Awesome.
The one thing that's, I mean, it literally would not come out. And I was like, all right, here we go. But those Body Count albums you did, they just sound so good. And like they get rap metal right. You know, they get the rap and the rap plus metal right. And, you know, just tell me a little bit about working with Ice-T. I know you probably get this one a lot, but I mean, I literally listened to that album like 1,000 times.
Oh, he's great, man. They're like one of my favorite artists to work with for sure. Super open to, I feel like when I first met them, they were self-aware to know that they needed to sort of revamp what they were doing. And like, if they were going to re-enter the world as a band, you know, in the climate today, that they wanted to change it up. So it's nice to work with a band that has accomplished so much and is this sort of veteran status, be just so down and open to like trying new things and changing and evolving with the times and stuff. And Ice-T's done a great job over his whole life in music, right, and movies and television of just staying relevant. Like, so he cares about what's happening currently. He wants to remain a presence in the music world. He doesn't have to do music. Like, he has a clearly successful career, but right, like, it's fun to him. He likes to use music. Is the same for the same reasons I write music. You know, it's his creative outlet. It's his way to have fun, express himself, yell at things, point the finger, like tackle issues that bother him. Like, it's just a great release and a way to get out of his system. And like, we connect on that level because we both do music for the same reasons, you know. And it's really, really fun to make those records. He's hilarious. Those guys are great. And yeah, we have a good time. But I think like the like uniqueness and the attitude and all the like, you know, everything that makes Body Count, you know, special is because it comes from that real place where these guys, you know, they just care about what they're doing. They just want to do a band to serve the creative endeavor that it is. And it's not about getting big or being this or being that or pleasing anyone. It's literally them doing what they want to do. And that's why that stuff translates well.
I really liked that they brought in so many outside writers and gave so many people opportunities to be on those records. Like, I believe Doc Coyle wrote for that, and Mark Borton, I think, maybe helped out there. I think I'm wrong on Mark, but I know Doc helped out. I'm just saying, like, they're bringing in the outside help, and then also bringing in, you know, Randy and those guys to do Randy and Max and all those guys to do, you know, guest vocals.
Yeah, we did a song, wrote a song with Max, which is really cool. Especially for me, because I was a huge Max fan growing up and stuff too. So it was really,
oh, yeah, who's not,
riff on a song together with him. And yeah, I mean, that's what I mean. Like, they know what, you know, is cool, and they're aware of like the people that are relevant in the world that back Body Count too. So it was like nice to get other brains in on certain songs and have features and stuff that are a little out of the box, but make sense, you know? So it's always fun putting those together.
So for this latest album, you know, what we said, Oh, What the Future Holds. When did you kind of start getting the ideas for this album together? And was this obviously a pandemic, you know, written and recorded record, and so forth and so on?
It was a pandemic record. We were probably planning on doing a record later, like I'm sure every other band in the world was, because we had like a whole year of touring booked. And, you know, I think we wound up canceling 6 tours over the pandemic. And we had so much cool stuff planned that obviously went by the wayside, like everybody else. Not complaining, it's just what it is. But I was like, well, you know, it's going to be a minute before touring comes back. Our record's going to be old. I bet you a lot of people are going to have new stuff. We should just do a pandemic record, you know? And I liked it because it kind of freed up. We had more time to make a record than I think we've ever had, you know, the pressures of like, we got to squeeze it in before this tour, or there's only these windows, or I'm busy. We were very, very busy at the studio because everybody made records during the pandemic, but a lot of international stuff just turned into mixes because I couldn't get the bands here, you know, so I was shaving weeks. The schedule turned into, hey, I got free time like all year. So instead of booking stuff, I was just like, cool, let me chip away at the writing. I got to have multiple sessions. I got to leave stuff and come back to it. Like, I've never really put myself through those paces, like where I could be like a bit more relaxed coming up with stuff. And it worked out good. I wrote more songs than I ever had for a Fit record. And well, I got to do multiple sessions with Joe, which is really cool. We got to live with some lyrics, come back to stuff. It was like the easiest recording process for Fit we've ever had in that sense.
When it comes to lyrics and things like that, are you heavily involved in that, or do you let the vocalist do that, or what do you do?
I do a bulk of the writing for Fit, like generally pretty much write more or less most of the lyrics, and then kind of bring, I'm pretty heavy handed on all the music, and then kind of bring the guys in to fine tune, tweak, do everything. But a lot of it starts in my brain. So, and Joe is like really, really cool with me sort of taking the charge, and he's just like the perfect guy to execute a lot of the ideas I have, and throws his own stuff into and does his spin on things. So it's like the sum of all those parts is usually works out really good for us.
When you go for lyrics, where do you tend to go? Like, do you go, you know, do you go inside? Do you write about fictional things? You know, not a whole lot of dragons on the Fit for an Autopsy stuff, but you know,
not a whole lot of dragons. Yes,
should be some more dragons, but
yeah, I mean, we grew up in the hardcore scene, most of my band, and I think a lot of the connection that I have to that stuff is because there was meaning to a lot of those songs and messages that were pretty defined and clear. And it's definitely something we carry with us through Fit, where every song has a point, there's purpose to it, and there's a message, whether it's like, you know, there's, you usually get two angles from us. It's usually we're pointing the finger at something and we're yelling, or awareness raising, or, you know, on the attack. But then there's also like the more internalized side of it, where it's like, okay, how does this thing's happening in the world, it's a disaster, like how does that affect you? And it's like more reflection on the human condition and what living in this world does to a person, you know. And the lyrics generally bounce back and forth between the two, sometimes even within the same song and stuff. I feel like it's the combo of those two things that add the depth and sort of weight to then, and a little more of the emotion to the aggression that the genre, you know, typically puts forward. And I like that approach. We did that a lot on this record. And it's, to me, I feel more connected to lyrics that do both things like that.
Did you try to stay away from doing any COVID writing, like, you know, a pandemic writing, you know, trying to keep those kind of those things away, just because you didn't want to like maybe time capsule the record?
Yeah, we didn't really write about it. We wrote around it in the sense that there are problems in the world. This is probably the result of some of those things, you know, but there's not really a specific, like, yeah, there's songs about being stuck in your house. Like, right. It's not as interesting to me. I think there's just bigger stuff to talk about. I mean, I'm sure there's good ones that came out of the pandemic. It didn't appeal to me in the sense where I didn't think I could write a song as interesting as some of the other things I was more fired up about. Like, I didn't want to be stuck in my house, but I didn't want to write a record about it either. I wanted to like go bigger, I guess, for lack of a better word. But yeah, not too much pandemic lyric wordplay on this one. It was just other concepts that enter my brain.
But with your line of work, I mean, being stuck in the house is kind of what you do anyway. You're kind of,
it wasn't that much different. Yeah.
Right.
My new studio is a home studio, basically, where there's like a studio section of it and then a section where I live. So it was, a lot of it was kind of business as usual here. You know, we didn't really like, obviously it was weird not being able to like interact with friends or see family or go out and stuff, but like we worked, you know, we kept making records. Every day sort of felt kind of normal at the place. So it was like all of the Stockholm syndrome, being isolated, like it didn't really phase us over here. Like it probably affected a lot of other people, you know, which I'm fortunate that we were still able to do our job through the pandemic, obviously, like booking agents and managers and bands whose livelihoods depend on touring, like took a hit big time, and I definitely feel for all those, and I feel very lucky that we were in a position where we could continue to just make music, you know.
I'm eyeballing the heads behind you. How often are those heads used as opposed to like a you know, a Kemper or things like that? Are you big into using actual heads and amps and things?
I am. I've got a whole wall of them.
Right, then.
A couple over here. We go that
oh,
way.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. It
keeps going. There we go.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely a real amp guy. I spent a long time. I've designed a plugin which was like, I want something that's as close to amps as possible, you know, and I worked with STL Tones, and we came up with this really cool plugin, which basically just copies these in plugin form. They did a really, really good job, but I could only fit a few of them into the plugin. So now I have more, but I just prefer real amps generally. Obviously the setup, it's a pain in the ass. It's more expensive. It's annoying sometimes, but, for the given tone or the given band, there's like, it's hard to beat the real thing. Not really like a Kemper guy or an Axe FX guy. I've never really got anything where I thought it really competed with what my normal setup was. But I mean, there are people that can pull great tones with anything. I think honestly, it doesn't matter what the tools are. It's just what tools work the best for you. You know, I get asked about plugins versus real stuff and things like that all the time. And it's like, there are number one songs on the radio right now that are, you know, all made with all plugins, and some of the best sounding records that have come out in the past year or two were mixed with a laptop. And it's like, if you know how to use your tools well, you can do anything with anything, you know. So for me, I like amps because my approach is sort of just is tailored to use them, but it's not the end all of good sounds.
So I guess that kind of, when you hear things that you've heard, you know, you're like, oh, that's a plugin, like when you hear a new band and somebody's like, Will, you gotta check out this new band, it's awesome, and you put it on and you're like, ugh, that's like every, this is that plugin, this is that drum effect. Like, do you nitpick or do you listen?
I don't care about production that much. It's funny.
Okay.
I listen to songs because most of the time the intention of the song is the song. It's what the band wrote. And then, sure, there's a producer that impacts his vision on it. But I know I just listen to music. I like music that makes me feel a certain way. And unless the production is like a nightmare where it ruins it, I don't care that much. Like, I probably should. I get asked about like other producers I like and stuff all the time. And I'm like, fuck, I don't know. I probably should know more. But if I hear songs that I like, I try to tune out the production, you know. Unless it's over the top offensive. But I think a lot of my favorite bands don't necessarily have stellar production work. It's probably a little more raw anyway, which is probably what I gravitate towards when I listen to music. But yeah, production doesn't ruin good songs for me.
I can see that. I mean, you know, I'm assuming you grew up on some of the same stuff I grew up on, like Minor Threat and Misfits and all that stuff. And that just stuff sounded like, most of the stuff sounded like garbage. But
yeah,
those songs came through all of those recordings and stuck in your head, and you know, you still love them to this day.
Yeah, there's no I think a lot of my favorite records probably don't sound that great if I really put them under a microscope, but I don't care. It doesn't really I just like what I like.
Right. Yeah, that's like when a band that you love takes one of their old albums that may not sound so good and they re-record it, and you're like, the re-record never sounds as good. Like,
yeah, that's a double-edged sword because you want a record that stands the test of time today and stuff, but it's like, you're playing with fire there. That's tough. Re-recording records can be hairy. If you're attached to a certain thing and you change it, your fans are gonna let you know if they don't like it.
Over the years, I mean, I'm assuming, you know, like when you would sit down with the band and they would say, hey, we want our album to sound like X. Was there like a, did you see a trend of this album was the album for a while and then it moved on to this album for a while and then it moved on to that album for a while? Does that make sense?
I think so. I definitely, you know, there'll be records that come out where they'll explode or the songs will hit and, you know, there's always, I feel like in the world of metal, more so like the more modern metalcore and deathcore and things like that, there's always these like waves where there'll be like a band that will hit, they'll do something really interesting, And then there'll kind of be a couple years where there's just a lot of bands that come out and sound like that band. You know, the first time I can think of it was like when Killswitch Engage surfaced.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden there were all these singy choruses and they were playing riffs like Adam D and everything like that. But, you know, and it just it happens over and over and over.
I still feel like I still get demos today of new bands that just came out that I'm like, that's Killswitch again.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. It happens all the time. And it'll continue to happen. I mean, it's just, it's innocent. You hear something you love, you're inspired by it, you want to start a band, like you're going to borrow from it involuntarily, you know. And bands that put out classic records that break like that, it reshapes what genres do. So there's always that wave where, you know, something cool will happen and there'll be some people that chase that for a while. Then something else will pop up and the tides will turn that way. So like I've seen it over and over again over the years. And I've been lucky where a lot of the stuff I've worked with lately isn't really chasing anything. You know, there's a lot of bands that want to do their own thing that don't want to sound like anything else that's out there. I've made a couple records over the past year or two where we were trying to do something that hadn't been done, like that hasn't sounded like anything else. And you know, the new Knock Loose EP is a really good example. Like,
so good.
They wanted, you know, the vision for that was like, let's put something out that doesn't sound like anything else, even if it's like worse. They're like, they didn't like, we were like, let's just go for something that's wild and really go crazy with low end and really make it scary. And like, it, whatever that end is, even if it's like not as clean and hi-fi and pro as like even the record or whatever it was like, just do it anyway, because if we want our own lane, we want it to be, we want it to stand on its own and be a little different. So like I've been, I mean, that's some of the best record making stuff you could ask for, you know. And I've been lucky lately. I've been like able to take that quest with a few bands, and I'm the most interested in that, you know. If I get to pick my projects, like that's the top of the list for me to be able to do stuff like that.
Knocked Loose to me is such a like a breath of fresh air, because they don't sound like anyone else. They are a little harsh on the ears, but they are so good, and it just gives me hope that not everything has to be completely polished with a singing chorus and everything else. Like that's just like, it reminds me of like old Snapcase or something. Like it's just good. You know, it's like we talked about earlier, a good song is a good song.
Yeah. I mean, they're an extremely necessary band, and especially the size that they've grown into and everything. I think it's good for all extreme music when any band like that thing, I think it's good. When bands on that level, like when bands can rise to that level, it's just good for everybody. You know, and those are, if anybody was going to get it and get to the stage that they're at, I'm so happy it's them, because they are just the sweetest dudes. They've spent their whole lives and the whole acceleration of their career just being the nicest people, trying to put over other hardcore bands. Like, they really fly the flag for that whole community, you know, and to see them being embraced on bigger stages and stuff, it's just great. And it's only going to help everybody, you know. So it's like, I love the growth of that band, and super, super excited for those guys and their future.
Yeah, we did a Knotfest Twitch from Knotfest Iowa, and they came out and just absolutely like blew my mind.
Yeah, they're a really fun live band. If you haven't seen them live, I highly recommend it.
So when it comes to your plugin that you produced, or what, however you would say that, how can people find that?
Yeah, stltones.com. It's called the Tonality Plugin Suite. The idea was, I'd been approached about doing guitar plugin stuff before, but I was never really sold on any of the companies, because I had just really never used one that I thought sounded like the guitar tones I could get with real amps. So I was pretty off it for a while. I was definitely one of those amp purist guys. And I was like, I don't get this. It's not better than the real thing. And then, you know, I had talked to them. They got this software designer who made the one that I was like, all right, this is the closest one that I've heard, you know. And they were like, I was like, let's take this amp that's right behind me, that 5150. I've had it for like 20 years. I know exactly how it sounds. I know how it sounds versus other ones, you know. I was like, I will run this thing through the paces, send you what I need. You do this. Here's the schematics. Like, we busted it open. It was like, the guy spent a long time on it. I was like, if this thing sounds like my amp, I'm in on it. And then I opened the plugin up. They sent it to me the first time, and I was like, this is insane. This is literally like the sound, you know? So I was like, all right, they cracked the code. They figured something out digital that actually sounded like my setup. So I was like, let's do it. And we spent a long time developing that. We threw a lot of stuff in it, and yeah, it gets used all the time, you know, but it's obviously I'm biased to my own amp tones, but it's the only it's the plugin that I use on records and stuff. And up until that point, I had never used a guitar plugin for rhythm guitars or like main guitars on a record. And then ever since that's come out, it's been on a huge chunk of my records. A lot of mixes that I get, you know, from overseas or stuff where I don't have necessarily the time or the setup available to properly reamp with amps and things like that, I'll use my plugin and I love it. It's awesome.
Yeah, that PV5150, man, the band I was in the early 2000s, we had a PV endorsement, and I was kind of like, we're getting a PV endorsement? But then, like, I got my PV bass amp, and I was like, I think it was like a TX1000, I could be way off. Plugged it in, that's the best sounding amp I think I've ever played through. Even, like, getting into other bands after that, I would just wheel that thing in, plug it in, and hit, like, one note, and they'd be like, all right, you got the gig. Like, it just sounded so good.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the most classic metal amp of all time. And the new EVH ones are awesome, too. It's just, like, it's the sound of metal in an amp, you know? And, yeah, I mean, if anyone who would argue, I would ask them what their top five metal records are of all time, and I bet you if PV's on it.
Speaking of that, you know, when you first started getting into music, I mean, what were you getting into as a kid that really made you like get into metal?
I my path went from West Coast hip hop as a child, which is nice. Funny. My parents listened to very soft music, like Rod Stewart, Elton John, Neil Diamond, soft rock that I never really connected with. And, then I was a child. I was a product of MTV as a child and saw Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg. And I was like, this is the craziest stuff I've ever seen. I want to know everything about this. So I was like really into hip hop stuff early as a kid. Then there was the grunge explosion where I really gravitated towards Soundgarden, Alice in Chains and Nirvana and stuff like that. And I guess that was my segue into metal, you know, finding Metallica and Slayer. Pantera was probably the band that really broke it open.
Oh, absolutely.
Because that was just like, at that point, that was the most extreme, you know? And I was like, whoa, this is like a whole other level, a new level, you know? Right. Like, okay. As a kid, I hadn't experienced that. So that was really like, okay. And the groove elements that were there, it sealed the deal for me where I was like, okay, I like metal. I'll take the dive. And then, all the death metal stuff and Morbid Angels and Cannibal Corpses and Suffocations. By that point in my life, they already had discographies, you know? So I got to go back and sort of absorb all of this classic death metal, all the Florida bands, found the Swedish stuff, like, and it all just like steamrolled from there. In a parallel to all this, I find, you know, as a kid, I started a hardcore band with buddies, you know, from my supermarket job. And my first experiences were playing like, you know, going to and seeing like crazy New Jersey hardcore shows as a kid,
right?
Where we had this exploding scene with bands from New York and from the South, like the Tri-State Weekend show mini tours that all these local bands were doing. Like you could see Hatebreed, you could see Converge, Dillinger, God Forbid, Vision of Disorder, Candiria, like all this stuff was just here all the time. So I was sort of exposed to a whole world of subgenres, these mixed bill shows that happened like right down the street from where I lived in New Jersey. Super spoiled as a kid, like how active the scene was around me.
Right.
New Jersey's never seen the frequency of quality shows like it did in that era of time. You know, unfortunately, a lot of venues have closed here, and it's like fell from grace as being this like a markety kind of stop on tours and stuff. But man, when I was a kid, we got it all here, and I was.
I follow a New Jersey hardcore Instagram page that always posts old flyers. I'm like, this is so good.
And they just posted one yesterday of my first band, Struck Down. I was with, it was like an All Out War, Shadows Fall, New Jersey Bloodline. It's just this great, crazy show that I like, as terrifying as a child playing, you know, but it was like, man, we'd get these every week here. So I was like, I get to see it in real time. It inspired me so much to learn guitar, to be like, try to push the band further. It was really like that whole era of music for me was like, this is the heyday of my life, you know, discovering all that stuff.
Yeah, I think your path, I'm going to assume that we're about the same age, because I think that was very similar to my path. But, you know, with the parents that listen to Neil Diamond and Elton John, which the older I got, the more I appreciated, you know, going back and listening to some of that stuff, too. But yeah, man, just growing up and seeing like the seeds of the hardcore scene that would trickle down to, because I grew up in Nashville. And so you would see those shows coming through with like VOD and Hatebreed and all those bands, you know, just going to see like, you know, shows at VFW halls in Bowling Green, Kentucky and stuff. And just insane, man, to see that stuff.
Yeah. It was, I mean, the mixed bill shows were what was really cool. Cause I feel it introduced me to all of this different approaches to like extreme music, you know, and on MTV, and there wasn't file sharing like when we were kids. Like, I didn't see any of that stuff. You only saw the more commercial side of it and the Big Four and the things that are kind of rise to the top there. But like, you know, being able to kind of study that underground music stuff is like how I develop musical tastes, you know? And it's like, yeah, I don't know if I'll ever be in a position in my life again where I could be exposed to that much different kind of music in a live setting like that. I feel like almost that era is like gone, you know, but, at the time, I'm glad I was there for at least that part of it, because it really shaped my tastes and kind of probably was a big catalyst for why I'm making records today.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely like a romanticism about, you know, learning about or hearing, you know, seeing your favorite band wearing a shirt. You know, like seeing a band wear a Sepultura shirt, and you're like, oh, I wonder what this Sepultura band is. And then two more people say something about Sepultura, and you're like, all right, go to the record store, buy the cassette or the CD, get it home, listen to it then. But now it's like, if you see your favorite band wearing a shirt, you're like, hit the phone, you know, like, boom, it's right there. You know, there's no real, like, treasure hunt anymore.
You know what we used to do? We used to read the thank you notes.
Yep.
The thank you notes was where you would find stuff. We're like, who did Hatebreed thank you? I don't know. I know that one. I don't know that band. We used to like sort of, we used to go through the credits to see like, who are they friends with? What other bands did they know? They must have played shows with these bands, you know, like, so I used to like read thank you notes and like make a little, I had a little list of like bands from my favorite bands, thank yous that I'd never heard of, where I was like, all right, I got to find these bands. I want to check these bands out.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Thank you notes in the credits. I think bands should bring that back. I think bands should start their thank the bands in the album credits again.
I love the like 80s and 90s, like the everybody had a nickname. Like you wouldn't be, you know, it was like thanks to Will the Jaeger Bomb Putney, you know, like, you know, you would get a, you know, get a crazy nickname and like a in a thank you.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of them are like psychos and cartoon characters. They just needed names that fit the bill. But I mean nicknames still get thrown around. It was just a fun time. It was a fun time for music in this world.
And you're now the Jaeger Bomb, by the way.
Please don't make that stick.
I think I almost threw up in my mouth thinking about a Jaeger Bomb. So
that part of my life is over. No shade to Jägermeister, but I'm retired.
The other part, you know, you're talking about Pantera and the like the home videos of Pantera and just everything around that band, like, just made me such a big fan of them. Like being able to not only like the band but also learn about the crew and, you know, Terry Date and like everybody in the Pantera crew became famous.
Yeah, I mean, when VOD got Phil to do the song, that was a really big deal too, because I was like, oh, all my worlds are colliding. All the things I like are happening at once, you know? And then, yeah, I mean, I over the years gravitated away from metal a good bit and just wound up pretty immersed in hardcore for a long time. And I feel like a little later in my life, I began to appreciate some of the metal stuff a little more. You know, I think the real Swedish boom happened to me a few years later, where I was like, oh man, now this stuff is resonating with me for whatever reason. You know, I think there's the darker nature of some of that atmosphere in the European metal, you know, and all those bands just being on fire, then writing these great records, all that At the Gates, Soilwork, In Flames stuff, when those bands were in their prime, was just like, it was just unstoppable music, you know? So it was like, I had like a oh wow moment, finally like really diving into all that stuff. And yeah, I mean, I kind of like everything, you know, which is I think partially why Fit has created more dynamic music than we had originally intended. It was like we would just show our influences more, you know. It's just the sum of all the parts, I think, is what makes a lot of what I do now when I go to write music like more interesting to me, and hopefully more interesting to other people too who listen to it.
Yeah, the one album I tend to go back to with production that stands up, songwriting that stands up, and I think is more influential than maybe it gets a lot of credit for, is Carcass's Heartwork. I think to this day that album still sounds so good.
It's still awesome. The riffs are awesome. Like Carcass is one of those. Fit has like a handful of bands. We don't all agree on bands all the time, but we have like a short list where everyone is like, that band kicks ass. Like Carcass is like one of our four or five that everyone's like, yep, they called a tour. We go on tour. Like right. we love them. Fit was fortunate enough to tour with Arch Enemy a few years ago. And those guys got to meet Michael and like hang with him. And I'm sure Punish about Carcass stuff too. Yeah, we're longtime fans, and they're still putting out cool music.
Oh yeah, great new stuff.
Like their last release is great, and it's like to be that deep in the career and still make relevant stuff that kicks ass. Like that's so hard to do now, you know. And so it's just inspiring to see that the stuff you grew up on, those dudes still have quality output. Like it's awesome, you know. At the Gates is like that too. The last At the Gates record is awesome, and it's like, man, it's been 30 years. Like I haven't even done music for that. I haven't even touched a guitar for 30 years yet. Like to see that. You know, it gives me like inspiration and hope, thinking like maybe we could do this for longer than I thought, you know, when we started. So I'm always happy to see some of the old dogs return with really, really, really good records.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Back when I was just doing phone interviews, I did Jeff Walker, and people always ask me like, who did you get most nervous to talk to? And I'm like, Jeff Walker or Carcass?
I hear they're all nice, but there are certain.
He was great.
I won't talk to. Like I have like the aura of the band, like I want it to be preserved. I don't want the guy to be a dick to me. I also don't want him to be too nice to me either. I want to in my mind, you are this person and I want you to stay that way. And I was in like there are people that I'm intimidated to talk to sometimes because I'm like, man, I've like semi worshiped you for so long, I don't know what I'm going to take away from this. I try to so there are people that I'll purposely avoid just to not know. Like, I just want it to how it is in my head, you know?
Give me one name that you would not want to meet to ruin the aura.
The band that I didn't want to meet, which I did meet, and I actually did end up working with, was Gojira. Because they were unapproachable, ominous, like, this new thing for me, where I was like, I don't know, they're foreign. Are they going to be mean? Are they going to be nice? Like, I don't even know. We went to a show. Me and Machine went to a show in New York. It was when Lamb of God, it was when Randy was arrested, that crazy time. And that tour was canceled. And Gojira, I guess they had flights here anyway. So they booked a bunch of one-offs in New York. They put like 8 days in New York, I think, where they would bounce around playing where they could. And we went to a little venue, like a 200 cap room, saw them play like one of the crazy sets. And we had just like, I don't know how we connected to that, but we were just going to meet him that day. Cause we were both like into the band. We want to see what it is. And I was like, man, I can't even talk to these guys. And they were just so nice, immediately so approachable. And then years later, I got to meet him again. So nice. And, you know, we wound up working together a bit on Magma, and Joe is like literally just the sweetest guy. And in my head, I was like, is this guy going to breathe fire on me when I talk? You know, like I was like, I didn't want to, I was like intimidated by meeting this guy, you know? But it worked out really cool, you know? So maybe now I'll be more inclined to meet people, but I still have a few where I'm like, I'm not talking to you. You just stay over there.
Yeah, man. It's definitely crazy, man. When especially now that I'm doing more video, and like when the other person that pops up is Jason Newsted, you're like, you got to like kind of hold your breath a second and you know, say, hey, how's it going? But yeah, I mean, it's pretty nuts. Actually, I remember what I was going to ask you earlier. When you're sitting down and producing a record with someone, and you know, there's always the one take wonder guys, but I mean, my studio experiences were always, I had like the red light fever, whatever you call it. You know, as soon as you hit record, I just forget how to play bass.
Yeah.
You know, how often do you see that? And then in amazing players, you're like, God, this guy is great. But it's just like, as soon as that record button hits, man, just out the door.
The main thing I see which is it's hard to prepare for, is the it happens a lot with drummers, and it must be relative to the instrument, where they'll learn their parts a certain way, and probably the muscle memory and the physicality of just drumming.
Yeah.
Like, if I want you to move a kick over here or like add one little thing to the beat, it's like the guy forgot how to play it. Like, you know, and it, right. And in my head, I'm like, dude, I can play this beat. I barely play drums and I can play this. And I'm like sitting in front of one of the best drummers I've ever recorded, and the guy can't do the simplest thing, but it's because of his practice regimen, how he beats something into his head, and then me going, all right, now add this or change this. That throws a lot of drummers off. And I feel bad when I have to do it, but I have to do it, you know. So
right.
It always works out. But yeah, it's probably because of the nature of how drummers have to rehearse, and the way the muscle, it's like this full body muscle memory thing. That's the most common hang up with really, really good players. There's a couple guys that get nervous, and there's just a couple guys that, you know, stink in the studio, but are great live players. It happens, but I really do see it way more often with a drummer behind the drum kit when we're tracking.
Are you still blown away when you sit down with people and they play certain things and you're like, Jesus Christ? Like,
oh, that's all the time. I mean, it's all year. I'm always just like, this year's been awesome. I've worked with really, really great players, and that I'll see stuff where I'm like, yeah, I'm never going to be able to do that. That's like the common thing where I'm like watching somebody play and I'm like, I will never do that. No matter how much I think I'm going to practice, or when this session's over, if I'm going to riff, like, I'll never be able to do that. That's cool. You know, so
we have to get those times where
impressive guys here, you know.
Get those times where you're like, where did you even think to put those two notes together? Or, you know, how did you think of that riff? Like, you know, you just must be from another planet at this point.
Yeah, there's, you know, like I said, it's been cool watching, especially younger kids come up, where I was like, you know, at 18, I was like struggling to play through slight riffs, and you're like on some virtuoso level. You know, I think a lot of it too is, the way you can educate yourself nowadays, like the resources that are available. If you want to learn progressive metal or technical drumming or anything like that, like, you can go online, you can find the band you like the most. Maybe that drummer might have lessons, that guitar player might have a recording class or a course or something. Like, there are so many resources available to like the younger generation of players and stuff now. Back when I learned guitar, it was the local guy who taught guitar lessons by the music store, and it was like
by the tab book
the guy you learned from, you know.
Yeah,
and it was cool. You want to learn the Eric Clapton riff? Cool. Like, you know, like, you just learn what that guy knew, and now you can target what you want and go find a resource for it, and it's awesome. And I honestly think it's accelerated the genre and made younger players so much better. Like, I see it all the time, you know.
But do you also see maybe the other side of that, though, where they're super technical, but they can't write anything?
Oh, like,
they
can all the time. I'm talking about, I'm not talking about songwriting. I'm not a guy who loves technical music as a tool of songwriting. I think it's cool in parts. That's just my taste. Like, it's just, I'm not, you know, some of the more progressive stuff and some of the more shreddy stuff that's out there is like, I can appreciate it. Like, obviously these guys are awesome, but the music to me, like, I don't connect to, you know, like a lot of my friends like Arkspire, and Arkspire is unbelievably talented, but those songs don't like click for me. I hear it and I'm like, wow, this band is awesome, but I can't jam it, you know, like, I don't know. And it's mainly because I don't gravitate towards that style of music, but I can appreciate, like, wow, they're unbelievably talented. The work it went in to compose the song is bonkers. Like, it hasn't been designed for me. It's not my taste, you know?
So with the rise of home studios, being able to do it on laptops, I mean, what is your, I guess, pitch to people of like why a producer is still something that's needed, and mastering and mixing and all, like, every step of the way, you know, what's the pitch that says, like, you know, that's needed? Does that make sense?
Sure. Yeah. I think like anybody can create music on their own. You know, the tools are all there now. And a lot of people prefer to create music on their own and don't want to hear it from other people. They just want to do what they want. I do that. I want to make the music I want. I don't care what anybody else thinks. You know, it's my selfish little creative outlet. But if you want to take what you have and enhance it, hear a perspective from somebody who probably understands your music, you know, a producer is a super valuable tool, because it's, you know, it's somebody who can actually understand your band, find the things that are important that people can connect with and resonate with, and then enhance that, is like sort of pretty invaluable when it comes to like, you know, trying to sustain a career and things like that. So it's been, for me, that's like where I think record producers can excel. And I think it's why the importance of, you know, using them if you're in a band and you're trying to do this for the long haul and connect with as many people as possible, why it's an invaluable tool.
Awesome, man. Well, as we wrap up here, I do have a throwback throwdown question for you, and I threw it out there earlier for you. And just what is Will Putney, Fit for an Autopsy, producer extraordinaire? What would be your Mount Rushmore of producers?
The Mount Rushmore of producers. I got to give you four. Ooh. So you said this, but I didn't think about it.
Now, hey, man, I gave you an hour.
I know, but then we start talking, and I'm just, okay. Eric Valentine would get a check mark for Queens of the Stone Age alone. I think that's probably one of my favorite productions of all time. Who else do I put on the mountain? Ross Robinson. Absolutely. For being one of the craziest, most outside-of-the-box guys, who's definitely made seminal records and probably changed this whole genre, whether he realizes it or not. You know, I'll give one to Machine. I feel like I'll give him a spot on the mountain for his approaches that became some of my approaches. I feel like some of my favorite records came out of that guy's brain, too. And I got to give you one more. I'll go Kerpaloo. Let me go Kerpaloo.
There you go. Nice.
Or my probably as an overall aesthetic, some of my favorite modern day heavy productions and some of my favorite records in the past 5 years, I'd probably attribute a good amount of them to his studio. So current win for Kurt, for sure. That's four. That's it. I don't do that anymore.
You are good. You are now out of the throwback throwdown. Speaking of Ross Robinson, man, have you ever thrown a flower pot at anybody, or, you know, screamed at anyone's face to get them to a certain spot?
No, I'm not a screamer. I did chuck a pair of headphones against the wall the other day, but it wasn't anger at a band. It was an anger that the headphones broke. No, I think my methods are more like down to earth. Not throwing shade at Ross, though, because crazy works with crazy people sometimes, and he's had some wild ones in there. So I think you adapt to your surroundings and work within the dynamics of the people you're working with to make cool records. You know, he is out there, though. I'll give him that.
Another producer question: do you like when you like certain producers out there, like a John Feldman? Like, you know, he has a style, and you can kind of tell when he's produced an album as opposed to maybe not, because a lot of his albums kind of have the same elements to them. As a producer, do you like that, to have a style of a, hey, this is a Will Putney record, or this is a the best that this band can put out kind of thing?
The band style is the style that I shoot for. You know, I don't want to make all my records the same. I feel like if I did, it would be a disservice to the people who are hiring me. You know, I don't think John does that either, because John's worked within lots of genres. And
right.
I mean, everybody's got tricks, but John's definitely had a career making lots of different records for different styles of artists, too. But yeah, I think it's very short-sighted to only apply one thing or one sound or have your sound, you know, and then cycle that through a lot of bands. I don't think it does anybody any good. It makes records less exciting. It kind of takes the wind out of the creative sails for certain projects. Like, I think the goal is really to serve the record that you're making and the band that you're making, find their identity and make that as cool as possible. And if that requires more work or more tricks or different approaches, like, it's kind of what you signed up for. You kind of have to do that.
Now that I think about it, since Ross Robinson did the Vanilla Ice record, if he wants to do a follow-up to that, I think you would be a great person to put Vanilla Ice over the top.
I don't know if I'm down. I don't know. I think I'm down. I think for the stories, I'm down. And then I'm cool. Yeah.
Hey, that was a fun record, man. I bought it at Tower Records, and the guy at the checkout counter completely made fun of me.
I can understand that, too. I don't know. As a kid, I liked Vanilla Ice. To be fair, I got to go back. I know he came back on the new metal tip for a while, and it's a bit of a blur for me because I fell out of love with new metal for a few years. So I did miss that one, but you know what? When we're done, I think I'm going to go listen to it.
Hey, Ross Robinson did a good job on it. And it's the guys from Amen also playing on that album. So it's like the band of Amen plus Vanilla Ice. You know, you can't really go wrong with that.
All right. That's it. I'll check it out.
Well, cool, man. Well, as you know, as we wrap this up, man, what's the plan for Fit for an Autopsy new album, January 14th? We talking tour? You sending those guys away so you can have some peace and quiet for a minute?
Yeah, January 14th, the record comes out. They'll be on tour in the U.S. January 5th through February 12th. Got a big full U.S. tour. And then we'll be announcing some other territories soon. In May and June, we'll be in Europe on a headliner. And I think in the next week or so, Central America, South America, some Asian dates, hopefully some Australian dates, just waiting to make sure things clear up over there, and also some Canadian dates. So we have plenty of stuff all over the world, just waiting to be told we can go now. But we're all lined up. Europe and America are announced. Tickets are on sale now. And yeah, we're looking to get everywhere we can with the new record and play it in front of as many people as possible.
And production wise, do you know what's coming out soon that you've done?
I just wrapped up the new Straight from the Path record.
Nice.
We'll see the light next year. I don't know what I can talk about. I have to be careful because I don't know what's public knowledge yet. So there are a lot of records we made during the pandemic that still haven't come out too. So expect lots of studio output in 2022 for sure.
Awesome, man. Well, Will Putney, man, thanks for taking some time with me today. And this has been a pleasure.
Thanks, man. Appreciate you having me, man.
Open! Pandora! PlayStation.
Talk To Me podcast presented by NotFest.com. Follow the show at Talk To Me Talk. Be sure to subscribe, rate the podcast, and leave a review on your favorite podcast app to get the latest from the Talk To Me podcast.